Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about veganism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, www.compassionatecooks.com. Hi, everyone. I'm excited to announce that we've been nominated for a podcast award in the third annual podcast awards. So I urge you to visit www.podcastawards.com to vote for us. We are in the food and drink category, and it takes like 10 seconds to vote. You don't have to vote in any of the other categories unless you want to, and you just need to submit your email address because they need to verify your vote. You'll get an email. You click on the link and boom, you're done. So thank you so much for taking like 10 seconds to vote for us. It really doesn't take long. Thank you. Today's sponsor of our podcast is Kimmy Hess. Kimmy wrote to me a couple of times, and I'm just so immensely impressed with her honesty and humility, her openness, and her dedication. Her first email to me said the following: I am a meat eater. I chose to listen to your podcast as I was looking for more interesting vegetable recipes. Where better to go than to someone who exclusively eats them? At the start of my day, I would never have guessed that I would be writing to an author of a vegan podcast or supporting it, nor would I have gandered that I would have spent my day listening to 20 vegan podcast episodes, but I did. Even more bizarre in my life as I know it was purchasing a book entitled Becoming Vegan, but the power of your words have become a catalyst for change in my life. Tomorrow, I start a new day with new choices. A couple of months later, I heard from her again. She said, I wanted to thank you again for all your time and inspiration. I knew the more I listened to your podcast, the more dedicated and compassionate I would become towards animals. In the beginning, I started listening to you with an interest in eating better, eating more vegetables. Then it turned into a curiosity in others' lifestyles. Now I cannot find any justification for what we are doing to these incredible creatures. I tried desperately to hold on to old food values throughout my initial journey, but your voice would not allow me to do so. Your logic in your observation that, quote, some animals deserve our compassion and others don't, really had an impact on me. I knew the more I listened to you, the more dedicated and involved I would feel. Initially, I tried to listen just a little bit, like a forbidden fruit, knowing that the more I listened to you, the more work I was creating for myself. What I mean by this is I knew I would have to rethink my whole way of life. I have a lot of responsibilities, and I've been trying desperately to unload some of them. Reinventing my whole menu was not going to be easy, and I was trying to ignore it. But sure enough, I was drawn to your voice, and it has had an incredible impact. Things are going slowly, but definitely moving in a positive direction. Isn't she amazing? I was just so blown away by her email. I was just so blown away. You guys are all amazing. You're just amazing. You're doing it. You're making these changes. Or should I say these changes are making you, because that's what it feels like sometimes, doesn't it? You feel compelled to make the change, which is why the change itself is effortless, but the practical steps just take a little bit of work. And as I've said before, these are just habit changes. That's all they are, nothing more. In one of my 8-week long cooking classes, one of my students, who's probably in her 60s or so, commented on how nice it was to see so many young people in the class, and I agreed. But she went on to say that it's just so hard for her. It's just so hard for someone her age, and she wished she had done it sooner. And I just had to offer my thoughts about that, and I'll share them with you. Here's my theory about changing our habits at different ages, and I think it's a good theory, so I'm sticking with my theory. Most of us were raised in the same way. We were raised on a meat, dairy, and egg-based diet, most of us. And we carry these habits with us into adulthood. But here's the thing. A habit is a habit is a habit. By definition, a habit is something that's ingrained in us, And I hope you're not sick of etymology yet, but I just think etymology really helps illustrate things so much. The word habit originally referred to something worn. In Latin, the root word habitus applied to both inner and outer states of being. So it was something worn, whose meaning now is restricted to monks and nuns who wear habits. And it also applied to something taken or something given. Its base word meant to hold, in the sense of either an offering or a taking. So what's my point here? Well, I like thinking of a habit as something you wear, as something you can put on or take off. Because if you think about it, our habits regarding food are ingrained in us by the time we're, what, 5, right? I mean, like 5 years old tops, we pretty much eat as adults based on the habits that were ingrained in us by that age. So it doesn't matter if you're 30 or 40 or 18 or 80, a habit is a habit is a habit. It's no more difficult for someone at 20 to change his habits than it is for someone at 70 to change hers. They say it takes 3 weeks to change a habit. I like the idea of giving you an extra week, so I change it to 30 days. But my point is that it's not 3 weeks for someone at 18. It doesn't take 3 weeks, that's, you know, for someone at 18 to change a habit, and 3 months for someone at 70. It's all the same. It's 3 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. A habit is a habit is a habit. And if you're willing to make the change and literally cast off your old ways, your old habits, your old choices, then you can do it, no matter how old you are or what your cultural background is. I do, however, think the key is making sure you replace old habits with new ones. Then they become the habits and you never look back. Okay? That's why anyone who's on the other side and looks at vegans and says, God, it must be really hard to be vegan, is just wrong. It's not hard. Yes, there's a learning curve when you transition, but once you're over the learning curve, you've created new habits and you wear new vestments. Okay? So where am I going with all this? I don't know. It's Kimmy's fault. Somehow I got onto this topic because of her. But thank you again, Kimmy. Thank you so much for your support and for all the amazing work you're doing. Please stay in touch. And if you'd like to sponsor this podcast, you can do so by visiting CompassionateCooks.com and clicking on Support Our Podcast. Your sponsorships are so vital to helping keep this whole thing going. So I really appreciate your help. Thank you, everybody. Today, I want to talk about a claim I've heard, and perhaps some of you have heard, and perhaps some of you have claimed, and it goes something like, eating vegan is more expensive than eating non-vegetarian. Even more disturbing is a claim that says eating vegan is some kind of elitist position that arrogantly tries to impose its ideals onto the poor. I don't know if you've heard that one, but I have. So I want to talk about these two things today. To be perfectly honest with you, I'm always really surprised when people say that a plant-based diet is more expensive than an animal-based one. But we have to break this down. First of all, food is not a personal issue. It's not just a personal issue. It's political, period. So we have to look at a number of things when we talk about the economics of food. Number one, when I talk about a vegan diet, I am talking about a whole foods diet, not one based on expensive packaged convenience foods. We'll get back to a little cost comparison in a moment, but I am talking about a whole foods diet as our foundation. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. And for those of you who have been listening to the podcast, you should know that by now. Whole foods are those that are in their most natural state: fruits, vegetables, grains, beans, nuts, seeds, etc. Number two, the government subsidizes meat, dairy, and eggs, and yes, soy too, but soy grown to feed the animals that will be killed for human consumption, not necessarily soy that's being grown for your tofu, okay? And because of these subsidies and other factors, food is artificially priced. We do not pay the true cost of food. If we paid the true cost of food, or rather the true cost of animal products, people would be eating much less of them. Because of this artificially priced system, animal products are cheap and are available to the poor and everyone else. We aren't eating huge quantities of animals these days because people just really need them or because we want them so badly. We're eating huge quantities of animals these days because we can afford them, because they're cheap artificially. But that's not a good thing. Cheap food is not the answer. Cheap animal products is not the answer. In the U.S. in particular, producers of animal products actually create an excess of meat, dairy, and eggs. And these unhealthful products, the excess of these unhealthful products gets dumped on none other than two groups who have no choice and no voice: children and the poor. And we'll also get back to this. Related to that, cheap food, cheap meat, cheap animal products comes at very high costs. Maybe not in terms of dollars that people see coming out of their pockets, but in terms of health problems that could otherwise be prevented potentially, medical costs. There's a cost to the cheap labor hired to do the really tough work of harvesting our food, in many cases enduring toxic pesticides that lead to cancer and other diseases, and they're uninsured people, by the way, so they get these diseases and they actually can't treat them. There's also the high cost in terms of environmental degradation, forest destruction, pollutants in the water, the emission of greenhouse gases, the ridiculous amounts of resources that are required to produce these things. And of course, cheap meat and cheap dairy and eggs also comes at a very high cost to the animals who are forced to be our machines in the animal factories we've created. They pay the highest cost with their own bodies and with their own lives. And in turn, we pay the price of cognitive dissonance, the process that allows us to read children's books about cute farm animals while feeding children hamburgers. And we pay the price of desensitized hearts. We pay very high prices for cheap animal products. So let's start with the subsidies. The U.S. government, through the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, provides subsidies to the meat, dairy, and egg industries to make these products incredibly cheap and unnaturally cheap. The USDA formed originally, by the way, to promote the products of the animal agriculture industry. And if you think there's a conflict of interest when you have this department, which exists to promote animal products, also creating the nutrition standards, you're right. There is an inherent conflict of interest, but most people aren't even taught to explore this idea. If you'd like to explore this idea, I highly recommend you read two books in particular. There's lots of books out there, but these are two of the best. Food Politics by Marion Nestle, that's N-E-S-T-L-E, and Appetite for Profit by Michelle Simon, both of which are in my store. The U.S. government spends over $20 million on price supports, on subsidies that come from our tax dollars that benefit the dairy, beef, and veal industries. This money is given to farmers to artificially reduce the prices the public pays for dairy and meat. Fruits and vegetables grown primarily for human consumption are specifically excluded from USDA price supports. Grain growers also enjoy price supports, but that's grain that's fed to livestock, quote unquote, livestock, not people. And these subsidies encourage farmers to produce more, creating a glut in the industry and keeping the price of the product low, keeping it cheap. So what happens to the glut, all this excess? We dump these products on children through the National School Lunch Program and the poor through government aid programs. For example, the USDA purchases more than 73 million pounds of cheese annually, and they do the same for meat and egg industries, as well as for the fish industries. Michelle Simon, who I mentioned before, her book is Appetite for Profit. She's a very good friend of mine, and she's been writing about food politics for years, and she had this to say in an article she wrote a few years back. So I'm just going to quote directly from her article. Quote, "Schools are being used as a dumping ground for high-fat and high-cholesterol meat and dairy products with the ultimate goal of salvaging industry profits with taxpayer dollars. The government often buys out surpluses of various meats and cheeses from industry and then turns these unhealthy products over to our nation's school children for nothing or close to it. For example, when overproduction of milk pushes prices down, the USDA steps in to help. They help farmers by buying milk until the price rises again. Often it processes the milk into butter and cheddar cheese, foods very high in saturated fat, and then ships these foods around the country to dump on the National School Lunch Program. Schools depend heavily on these, quote, commodity items, consisting typically of 20% of the foods schools serve. The USDA spends $3 to $4 billion a year buying surplus foods for the school lunch program. In 1991, 90% of these foods were butter, cheese, whole milk, beef, pork, and eggs. All of these foods, besides being animal products, are loaded with fat, cholesterol, and sodium, one evaluation of the Commodity Foods Program indicated that 70% of the items offered exceed the U.S. dietary guidelines for fat. So the very same industry that is dumping these products on the schools, they're basically going against their own guidelines, the same USDA, the same guidelines that they create as far as guidelines for fat. So that's just an example of what we're talking about here. And Michelle goes on to tell a very interesting story about what happened when advocates tried to get soy protein, tofu, et cetera, in schools. She tells about Jennifer Raymond, a nutritionist, an author, and chef who's been trying for several years to get soy protein approved by the USDA for school lunches. If I haven't mentioned Jennifer before, let me just say that her cookbook, The Peaceful Palate, was my first vegan cookbook and still remains one of my favorites. So check out her cookbook, The Peaceful Palate. Anyway, here's what Michelle writes again. Quote, in the summer of 1996, prior to the fall elections, the USDA was just about to adopt a new regulation that would have made schools' use of soy protein 100% reimbursable. The regulation was inexplicably shelved. Then last May, Raymond met with USDA officials along with a small group representing the soy industry in an attempt to persuade the agency to release the previously stalled soy protein reimbursement regulation. Raymond described the scene. Here's Raymond's words. After we had all made our pitches, one of the USDA aides asked, "Have you met with the cattlemen, the Cattlemen's Beef Association? You know you need to do your homework and meet with them, because unless they approve this, we can't." And Michelle continues, "I was blown away. I mean, we all know who's really in charge, but to have him come right out and say it was mind-boggling. Most people have no idea about the money and politics behind the food that's served in the school cafeterias around the country. That a USDA official would openly admit to the unfettered power of the meat industry over a major food assistance program is disturbing evidence indeed of the high stakes involved in the politics of food in this country." End quote. The idea that advocating veganism is somehow keeping the poor downtrodden couldn't be further from the truth. The meat, dairy, and egg and sugar machines are powerful, powerful behemoths, and the government supports them through subsidies and buyouts. By keeping meat, dairy, and eggs cheap, they're perpetuating the unhealthiest foods on the planet, keeping the poor poor, keeping the sick sick, keeping the poor sick. We've also known for a long time that we can feed a hungry planet. The problem is not that there's not enough food. The problem is poor distribution or lack of it. And the problem is that we're feeding farmed animals the food that could feed the hungry. You've probably all heard this before, but according to information compiled by the United States Department of Agriculture, over 90% of all the grain produced in the United States is used for feeding livestock. Quote, livestock. Cows, pigs, lambs, chickens, and these animals wind up on dinner plates. And the process of using grain to produce meat is incredibly wasteful. For example, again, information from the USDA's Economic Research Service shows that we get back only 1 pound of beef for every 16 pounds of grain. In terms of calorie units per acre, a diet of grains, vegetables, and beans would support 20 times more people than a diet of meat. As it stands now, about half the harvested acreage in America is used to feed animals. If the Earth's arable land were used for the production of vegetarian foods, the planet could easily support a human population of 20 billion. In a report submitted to the United Nations World Food Conference many years ago, an agricultural economist at France's National Agricultural Institute said that the, quote, overconsumption of meat by the rich means hunger for the poor. Eating a plant-based diet is the answer, not the problem. So let's talk about the healthcare costs. According to a representative at Blue Cross, healthcare costs are estimated to be climbing 6% a year, which is an unsustainable level. Coronary bypass surgery, cholesterol-lowering drugs, diabetes drugs, dialysis, these are all incredibly expensive. A bypass surgery or angioplasty procedure can cost nearly $60,000. And how many people who undergo these treatments have no insurance? Who are these people who have no insurance? They're the working poor, they're the elderly. In the vast majority of cases, an unhealthy cardiovascular system is the result of lifestyle, namely poor diet, the very diet the government is perpetuating in the current political system that supports the animal exploitation industries, but not the public, and certainly not the poor. I mean, come on. We know how huge a role diet plays in these preventable diseases. There are studies all over the place supporting this. Thousands and thousands of studies support this. Just one, a 2003 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, concluded that a vegan diet is as effective as statin drugs in lowering LDL cholesterol levels. We know this to be true. A plant-based diet would empower millions of people and would be a lot more affordable for people than living a life dependent on drugs. Can you think of the ramifications for the multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical companies if people actually started changing their diets and stopped living on pharmaceuticals? A really good article was published recently. I'm not sure if the original publication was MSN Money, but that's where I read it, at MSN Money. It's called Go Vegetarian to Save Money. Not Go Vegetarian and Save Money. Go Vegetarian to Save Money. They talk about a number of components that actually make a vegetarian diet cheaper than a meat-centered one, even when you consider the government subsidies for animal products. And one of the things the article talks about are the healthcare costs for a vegetarian or vegan versus those of a meat eater. And here are a few points they make. Quote, overall, the healthcare costs for a vegetarian or vegan are much lower than for non-vegetarians. Less chronic disease, better heart health, and a lower risk of certain cancers are all benefits of a vegan diet. Health insurance agencies are promoting lifestyle changes to try and offset the costs associated with heart disease in particular, but there are still no discounts available for those who follow a vegetarian or vegan diet. But I was really glad they did this article because I've been wanting to do a podcast on this topic for a long time, but I just dreaded the research that it would take to compare the cost of plant foods per pound versus meat per pound. So here are some of the numbers in the article. Animal proteins are generally more expensive than plant proteins. Plant proteins are cheaper than the equivalent amount of animal protein. I remember I was listening to NPR one day and I heard this, I think she was just a local representative who wanted to see what it was like to live on the number of dollars that welfare recipients had to live on. And I remember, you know, the camera followed her around the grocery store and she had to go and purchase food. I can't remember the exact amount. She was buying food for a week. Maybe she had $19 or something like that. And she was buying, you know, food for the week. And it was so frustrating because she had some vegetables and she bought some other things like toilet paper, whatever. But she went over when she went to the cash register. It was too much money because she had this big, big chicken. And it was putting her over and she was like, gosh, I don't know what to do. Like, I really need the protein. I really want to make sure we have the protein. And so I can't remember what she did. I think she put something else back, but I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, go get the beans, go get the other, you know, really inexpensive food that would last you a really long time. And if it's, you know, it's plant protein, it's obviously better for you, et cetera. So, plant proteins are cheaper than the equivalent amount of animal protein. The cheapest cuts of beef, this is all according to the article, beef, quote unquote, such as ground round, average $3 a pound in U.S. cities. This is lean and extra lean. I hate saying these things. Boneless chicken breasts cost $3.40 a pound, and canned tuna is about $2 a pound. Contrast that with dried beans and lentils at less than $1 a pound, and rice well below $1 per pound. Though pine nuts are exorbitant, you can get sunflower seeds with nearly the same amount of protein at a fraction of the price. Even tofu, the chicken of the vegetarian world, is usually well under $2 a pound. From what I was able to glean from the article, I think some of the prices for grains and beans and nuts and lentils were actually from Whole Foods, which is a very expensive store. And I don't pay a dollar per pound for dried beans at my local grocery. I think I pay about 70 cents per pound. So I think some of those numbers for the plant proteins are even lower for many of us. They also price the vegetarian meat, such as veggie dogs, and found, for example, that they cost about $5 a pound. And turkey hot dogs, according to the article, are less than half that. So again, I cannot emphasize enough that when I talk about vegan food, I'm talking about whole foods, vegetables, fruits, grains, nuts, beans, lentils, mushrooms, herbs, spices. I'm not talking about packaged, processed, and frozen convenience foods. If you want them as a novelty once in a while, that's fine. But in terms of the most healthful food and in terms of the least expensive food, stick with whole foods. Make whole foods the foundation of your diet. Also stick with bulk foods. I know it seems like a big ordeal to make something like beans from scratch, but it really doesn't take any time on your part. If you make them from scratch, yes, they first need to soak for 8 hours. So soak them while you're sleeping. Done. Then they'll need to cook for about an hour and a half or 2 hours, depending on the bean, which can easily be done on the weekends or when you're cleaning the house or at night when you come home from work or you're doing the dishes or watching TV. So I don't want to hear any excuses about it taking too long. There are ways to do it from scratch. And again, it's a lot cheaper. On beans, I just wanted to say this about beans. I do hear sometimes people say, oh, I didn't know you could eat canned beans. I didn't think canned beans were healthy. And I usually say, well, what kind of beans are you eating now? And they say, well, no beans. And I say, okay, well, let's see. Canned beans versus no beans. I'd rather see you eat canned beans than no beans. Eat your beans. I don't feel that you're gaining a huge difference in nutrition, a little bit, but not a ton, when you eat beans you've made from scratch versus beans that come from a can. I think what you gain mostly is felt in the cost. You know, it's obviously cheaper to get them dried and then soak them and cook them yourself. And I think you're also gaining a lot more in flavor. They're just fresher. Yes, canned beans also have a lot of sodium, but I always rinse my canned beans before I eat them. So that takes care of that. The bottom line is a can of beans is a heck of a lot more nutrient rich than any animal product, and it's still a lot cheaper. So if you don't make your beans from scratch, then do eat your canned beans. The bottom line is just eat your beans. So related to items in bulk, one of the reasons they're cheaper is because they aren't laden with all the marketing stuff that goes into practically every food product on the grocery store shelf. I mean, you know that companies pay to have premium shelf placement in the grocery store for their products, right? Like, for example, the cereal aisle, all the crappy, sugary cereals are placed where children can see them and beg for them. The kids are usually, you know, sitting in the cart, so it's usually at their eye level. And the healthier cereals are either way, way, way up on the top shelves or way, way, way down below where you can't even see them. Okay, so buy in bulk. You're doing away with all the money that comes from marketing and all of the packaging, which is a benefit to the environment. We just have to change our really myopic, short-sighted thinking. There are so many other things to consider beyond our immediate experiences, beyond that immediate moment. Let's talk about organics. Another thing people say is, oh, you know, organic produce is so much more expensive. But it's important to keep this in mind. It's not that organic produce is necessarily expensive. It's that a lot of the products people buy are artificially cheap. Does that make sense? So you're looking at a food, like when you go to the farmer's market and buy directly from that farmer, you're paying the true cost of that food. You're paying the true cost of that apple. Also, organic fruits and vegetables are usually not grown on an industrial scale, so efficiencies aren't as great. Also, as pointed out in the article, quote, there are also significant costs involved in switching farmland from non-organic to organic status, and there's a lot more manual labor involved, such as weeding by hand. So it's not that organic is expensive, it's that non-organic is cheap. I hope that makes sense. But buying local is really the best thing you can do for so many reasons. First of all, the taste is absolutely superior. The fruits and vegetables that are grown locally, you know, that are grown at your local farmers and they are sold at the farmers markets, they're grown with flavor in mind. When you buy produce that's been shipped in from all over the world, the produce is grown not with taste and flavor in mind, but rather with its ability to withstand the long shipments and sit on the shelf for long periods of time. That's why the flavor is so much more amazing when you buy local organic produce. Also, when you buy local produce, produce, you're purchasing produce that's seasonal, you know, grown according to the climate of the region in that season in which you live. And seasonal veggies are generally cheaper than purchasing out of season fruits and vegetables. And it's important to keep in mind that cost doesn't refer only to dollars, as with the health costs that comes from eating an animal-based diet that we mentioned before. There are also environmental costs. And when you buy locally at a farmer's market or through something like community-supported agriculture, it means you're paying for food that was driven down from, like, what, a couple hours away, as opposed to being shipped in from thousands of miles away. That's a huge savings in terms of the resources required to get that food to your table. Resources that include oil, fossil fuels, electricity. In terms of organic produce, when you purchase organic, you're supporting a growing system that works with the earth rather than against it. You're paying for sustainable growing methods that enrich rather than deplete the soil. When you purchase out-of-season produce that was shipped in from other countries, there are also concerns about food safety. The growing standards in other countries may not be the same as those in the U.S., or more specifically, as high as those of the farmers you can talk to at the markets. I mean, you can find out exactly how they grow their food, and in many cases, you can also visit the farm yourself. Just a quick note about organics versus local. Sometimes you go to a farmer's market, and though they're local, they might not be organic or certified organic. And it's important to talk to the farmers, because just because they don't have a certification of organic, it doesn't mean they are growing with pesticides. So it's important to ask them, you know, do you spray? What do you use? What kind of methods do you use? Talk to them, engage with them, and find out how your food is being grown. Because lots of times it takes a while for them to get certified. The process is actually long, and the process is also expensive. So just because they're not certified organic doesn't mean they aren't organic. Okay, so talk to the farmer. That's another benefit of going to the farmers markets. While we're talking about the cost of food here, I think it's worth saying that personally, I believe we eat a lot more than we need to, and we also waste a lot more food than we should. A University of Arizona study several years ago documented that 40% of the food grown in the United States is lost or thrown away at the cost of at least $100 billion annually to the economy and overtaxing the soil and environment. And there are hungry people in this country. There shouldn't be one hungry person in this country. Again, we have the food to feed everybody. Timothy Jones, who is a University of Arizona archaeologist, and he was involved in this study, said that losses from households were the most surprising. He discovered that about 14% of the garbage involved perfectly good food that was in its original packaging and not out of date. I know there are a lot of people who throw out produce that has gone to waste because they didn't use it. Produce that's sitting in the fridge that starts to go limp because you weren't using it. So please listen to my podcast episode called Eat Your Vegetables for tips on using produce and making sure that they don't go to waste. Also, get a compost bin and compost your own vegetable scraps if your city doesn't have a compost system. That way you can use that compost in your own garden, or if you don't have a garden, you can give it to neighbors. So you never really do waste food. And you can get compost bins. First of all, check out places like Craigslist. Lots of times people are giving away their compost bins or selling them for less expensive. And also, for instance, in my area, the county actually sells compost bins for a discounted rate. So you can find out if your city has a program like that. And then places like what's the website, like Gaiam, G-A-I-A-M, they sell compost bins that might be more expensive. So, or look at your local garden store, your hardware store. You can also make your own compost bin. Actually, check out greenoptions.com. I bet there's a way to make a compost bin, the procedure on how to do it at that website. It's really a wonderful thing to do. And just as a quick note, and we will talk more about gardening at some future date, but the compost bin that I prefer is the kind that actually rolls. It sits on a little track, and you roll it so that you can keep it moving, and the compost develops actually very quickly. We've used several different compost bins, and that's our favorite. I think it really works the best. So look for that one. So anyway, we're wasting food. We kind of have this idea that there are endless resources out there, especially those of us who are privileged and have never had to go hungry. But if we're really concerned about spending less money on food, one thing we can do is not waste it. And another thing we can do is eat less of it. And what I mean by this is that I think we have some irrational fear of deprivation. Plus, we've been convinced that our plates have to look a certain way or that we wouldn't be full if we didn't have so much food on our plates. I see a lot of people discover that what they didn't think was going to be enough for them when they begin to eat more simply, when they begin to eat a whole foods plant-based diet, really is plenty of food, and they feel a lot more satisfied than they thought they would. We're not supposed to feel disgustingly full after we eat. We're not supposed to have to unbuckle our pants or lie down after we eat. Food is supposed to energize us. It's not supposed to make us feel sick. But so many people in affluent Western countries eat until they feel this way. I mean, to be really honest, food exists so that we can take in enough calories so that we can function as human beings. Food is calories. Calories equal energy. That's it. But we bring all this stuff to our meals. We bring all of this stuff to our food. But when you switch to a plant-based diet, you really do wind up feeling so much lighter because plant foods are just naturally much less calorie dense than animal-based products. And also you get so much more bang for your buck because plant foods are also so much more nutrient dense and they're a lot less expensive. I always get really, really sad when I pass by a fast food restaurant and I see a sign that says something like $1 for a triple hamburger or $2 for a bucket of chicken's legs or some such insult. Not only have the animals suffered so much in life, but their bodies are sold so cheaply once they're dead, selling them off and killing them just to make them into someone's lunch is horrible enough. But there's something even worse about their bodies being bought and sold so cheaply. Cheap meat, it's no bargain. Cheap animal products, no bargain. Not for the animals, not for the earth, and not for the people who consume them. This is Colleen from Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.